geography and in geography in a way of strategic behavior. And I think that the Iranian can still absorb and they can retaliate in case of any new aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think it will be disaster for Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ali Hami, expert in military strategy, for telling us what really happened on the ground, because a lot of Western mainstream media is hiding these facts from the Western public and the Western viewers. So thank you for your time and your contribution. Ladies and just stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about hunger has become a weapon in Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Gaza, the line between life and death has been reduced to a line for food. What was once called humanitarian aid has become a trap where hunger is weaponized and survival is met with live fire. Backed by U.S. funding and Israeli entity force, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has turned aid distribution into a killing field, prompting growing international accusations of genocide. More details in the following report.
In Gaza today, hunger is not just a crisis, it's a death sentence. As starvation tightens its grip on the besieged enclave, more than 700 Palestinians have been killed, not by bombs, but while desperately seeking food. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 743 people have died and nearly 5,000 have been wounded at so-called humanitarian aid distribution sites run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, a project backed by the United States and Zionist Israel. These are not combat zones. These are food lines. The people here, many of them children, are dying for a piece of bread. Mothers are skipping meals. Families are starving. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began operations in late May, but instead of relief, it has become a theater of horror. The controversial foundation, backed with U.S. funding and guarded by American contractors, stands accused not only of overseeing lethal force, but of providing a green light for direct killing. American guards have reportedly opened live fire and thrown stun grenades into unarmed crowds waiting for food. Witnesses and aid workers have reported repeated incidents of live fire, stun grenades, and tank shelling near these food points. A recent Associated Press investigation confirmed that American contractors witnessed live ammunition being used against civilians. Now, damning revelations from inside Zionist Israel itself. Haaretz reports that Zionist Israeli soldiers were not acting rogue, but actually following orders. Orders to shoot at unarmed civilians waiting for food. One soldier described it plainly. It's a killing field. Between 1 and 5 people were killed every day where we were stationed. The Israeli occupation says it has launched an investigation into possible war crimes. But for many in Gaza, justice delayed is justice denied. The evidence is mounting. This is not just a humanitarian crisis, it is a genocide. The U.S., the principal weapons supplier, has funneled tens of billions in bombs, jets, artillery shells, and targeting intelligence, despite clear warnings that these arms are being used in grave violations of international law. Critics, including UN Rapporteur Francesca Albanese, say this militarized aid scheme is deepening the genocide. The U.S. is no bystander. It is an enabler. This is no longer just a humanitarian crisis. It is a war on survival, a war where food is bait and hunger ends in bloodshed.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, political writer and analyst and journalist at the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thanks a million for being with us. Mr. Hamza, now, given the mounting death toll and eyewitness accounts, how would you characterize the role of this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation in what many are now calling a deliberate policy of starvation and of massacre. And how does this really fit into the broader Israeli entity strategy inside of Gaza?
Greetings to you. What is known as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is, in fact, one of the tools being employed by the Zionist occupying entity in its confrontation with our people in Gaza. First and foremost, this so-called foundation plays several roles, the most important of which is laying the groundwork for what is intended to become a new governing authority in the post-ceasefire phase in the Gaza Strip. So today, regardless of the specific actions being carried out by this organization, and despite the tragic scenes we witness daily in the media of hundreds martyred while waiting for aid, and the roles played by its members, whether American contractors or so-called Palestinians, its function is fundamentally political. We've seen similar patterns before, including in Lebanon and other regions during wartime, where such organizations were established and led by locals, whether Lebanese in our case or Gazans in the Palestinian context, with agendas far exceeding the distribution of humanitarian aid. In Lebanon, for example, some of those individuals later became prime ministers, ministers, party leaders, and key players in national political life, both in Lebanon and abroad. The model in the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is designed to be replicated in the Strip, as Zionist Israel has openly stated in its intentions. It's alternative actors to take over governance in Gaza. This humanitarian gateway, so to speak, is being used by both Zionist Israel and the United States under the assumption that the besieged and bombarded Palestinian citizen will be easily deceived, that they will view any entity offering aid as a savior and, in turn, grant it loyalty or legitimacy.
There's something very interesting going on, Mr. Hamza, with the reports that even Zionist Israel saying, with Haaretz reporting about it, that occupation soldiers were actually ordered by their government to shoot unarmed civilians, and that American contractors, and we heard the videos, they also fired on aid seekers. How do you assess the U.S. full complicity in this, not just in terms of supplying arms to Zionist Israel, but direct operational conduct of this day-to-day war?
Exactly. This clearly proves that the United States is an essential and inherent part of this confrontation. Even before the issue of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, there was the matter of the floating pier in Gaza and the active American push for a direct U.S. presence on the ground in the Strip. Since that moment, the American side has become a key party to this war and to the various schemes the Zionists are attempting to implement in Gaza. Among them, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and the direct involvement of American contractors, as well as certain international organizations. Some of these organizations have issued detailed reports stating they will submit their findings to the UN Security Council, shedding light on the roles of these actors in opening fire, the types of munitions and weaponry used against civilians, and describing the entire operation as a deliberate trap designed to kill civilians through means other than traditional warfare, beyond the already brutal practices of the Zionist occupying forces, such as bombing infrastructure, committing massacres, and burning down tent camps. This foundation has now effectively become a deadly trap, executed by the Americans within their specialized sphere of this war. The U.S. entered Gaza under the guise of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, presenting their presence as a humanitarian initiative to provide aid to the people of Gaza, a move that was politically negotiated and framed as an act of compassion and assistance.
But if that were the case, we wouldn't have seen at the Rafah border, especially inside of Egypt, miles and miles of food trucks that were never allowed in. If this was only a humanitarian conduct for the United States of America, they would allowed those trucks to come in. So there is something political out of this organization.
Naturally, there is now a concerted effort to organize a core group from within Gaza, whether individuals, institutions, or entities, that can serve as the starting point for building a substitute governing body in the Strip. It begins with handing over the most urgent and sensitive responsibility, the distribution of aid. But it doesn't stop there. The scope of responsibilities assigned to this foundation is gradually expanding. Hence, the American presence on the ground in Gaza is not only deeply rooted in intelligence gathering. It is also playing a central role in shaping the political, economic, and social nucleus of the order they intend to install in Gaza after the war, in a phase they themselves refer to as the post-Hamas era.
الحرب وفي فترة ما بعد حماس.
I completely understand that view, but I need to explain something to the viewers here that we are nearing a two-year duration of genocide against the Palestinian people who now have fully not only stood by the resistance, but they fully put their fate in the hands of the resistance, which up until last night, they were still conducting operations against the Zionist entity. So how smart it is not to read the room before claiming that they have won politically, that they that the people will actually allow a new political force to emerge.
Just yesterday, confirming everything we've been discussing, some of those involved in distributing so-called humanitarian aid, individuals from within Gaza, publicly declared their core political agenda to eliminate the Hamas movement. They literally said, "We will continue to liberate the people of Gaza from Hamas." That was the exact term they used. This is a clear and undeniable revelation of the true intentions behind these efforts, a full exposure of the agenda we've been warning about. However, the decisive factor in all of this remains the stance of the people of Gaza themselves. As you rightly pointed out, 2 years into this brutal aggression, the resistance is still standing strong, actively carrying out operations. As you rightly pointed out, 2 years into this brutal aggression, the resistance is still standing strong, actively carrying out operations. And the Palestinian people, after enduring 2 years of relentless bombardment, siege, and deprivation, have not staged a single protest or public demonstration against the resistance, despite the immense suffering and sacrifices they've borne. This reality speaks volumes. The Palestinian people cannot and must not be cornered into a false choice between dying of starvation and thirst under massacres, or submitting to the rule of a blatantly collaborator regime that offers them food and water in exchange for their dignity and their cause.
Added to that, a lot of the wheat bags, they found to have been including certain medical drugs inside of them that were supposed to be given also to the people. That also speaks a lot. It actually speaks volume about how the United States of America operates. But we have now United Nations experts, Mr. Hamza, and human rights advocates that have increasingly framed what's happening in Gaza as a genocide. There's no way to hide this anymore, based on facts, testimonies, and military patterns inside of Gaza. How do you argue the case of genocide to the Western public? Because here in West Asia, we understand that. We see that. We live it. We have paid blood for it. And what should the global legal and political response be, especially at this moment in time when a lot of calls have been emerging about a possible near an end to what's going on in Gaza?
There is absolutely no room for debate over whether what has been happening and continues to happen in the Gaza Strip constitutes genocide. According to the 1948 Genocide Convention, the definition is crystal clear. Any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, religious group. When we compare this legal definition to the reality on the ground in Gaza, all the core components that allow us to identify genocide are present. First, the intent. From the very beginning of this war, Zionist officials in Netanyahu's government have openly and explicitly expressed their aim to annihilate Gaza and eliminate its population. This declared intent, including statements made by Netanyahu himself, is a matter of public record. Second, the deliberate patterns of aggression carried out by the Israeli occupation forces. Bombing of civilian infrastructure, repeated strikes on schools, the incineration of tents while their occupants sleep inside, destruction of places of worship. All of these are systematic, repeated tactics. These are not military operations in the conventional sense of warfare between armies or armed groups. These are direct, targeted attacks on civilians. This reveals a clear and deliberate strategy aimed at the systematic destruction of Gaza. Additionally, the repeated forced displacement of Palestinian civilians from the north to the center, then to the south of the Strip, multiple times within a single month, further confirms this genocidal intent. These displacements coincide with repeated statements from Netanyahu regarding plans to permanently expel Gaza's population, and with Donald Trump's previously declared intention to turn Gaza into a tourist resort, a so-called Gaza Riviera. The intent is clear. The actions are consistent. Together, they leave no doubt. What we are witnessing in Gaza is a full-fledged genocide by every legal, moral, and human standard.
Definitely. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, political writer and analyst, also journalist at the Lebanese Daily Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Silence in man was burning and keeping the light alive. A bone in his throat, a thorn in his eye. In silence in man was burning and keeping the light. To tell his secrets to our and bury his pains in the desert. A man who knew the ways in the heavens better than the ways on earth.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
Allah. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the commentary points of Surah Al-Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we were discussing the contents of the 82nd verse. Let's listen to the verse once again, and we'll be back with our episode.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَأَصْبَحَ الَّذِينَ تَمَنَّوا مَكَانَهُ بِالْأَمْسِ يَقُولُونَ وَيْكَأَنَّ اللَّهَ يَبْسُطُ الرِّزْقَ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ مِنْ عِبَادِهِ وَيَقْدِرُ لَوْلَا أَمَّنَّ اللَّهُ عَلَيْنَا لَخَسَفَ بِنَا وَيْكَأَنَّهُ لَا يُفْلِحُ الْكَافِرُونَ.
And those who had wished for his provision the previous day began to say, "Oh, how Allah extends his provision to whom he wills of his servants and restricts it."
So, dear listeners, in this episode, we saw how important it is to use our wealth, to make our wealth beneficial. And Islam approves a wealth in which there is good unto all, and it contains the meaning of goodness and charity and khayr to others. Because the Holy Quran says, "And be good to others just as Allah has been good to you." And the learned men of the children of Israel, in the very beginning, when they saw the treasures of Qarun, they told him in the first place that this kind of wealth is not a negative thing, but you must use it in the way of creating a better abode for your hereafter by means of what Allah has given you. And they reminded him that this is not your money, this is what Allah has given you. But the ending of such a proud man, a pride that is originating from wealth, is this: that even the people who wanted to have these treasures yesterday, أَصْبَحَ الَّذِينَ تَمَنَّوا مَكَانَهُ بِالْأَمْسِ يَقُولُونَ وَيْكَأَنَّ اللَّهَ يَبْسُطُ الرِّزْقَ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ مِنْ عِبَادِهِ وَيَقْدِرُ. Those who yearned for his position the day before were saying, "Oh, Allah enlarges the sustenance for whomever he pleases of his servants, or restricts it." And they know that this happening from the Almighty Allah, the fact that the Almighty Allah has not accepted their supplication or answered their supplication, is goodness, is a favor, it is a grace, and they have to be thankful of it. لولا أن من الله علينا لخسف بنا ويكأنه لا يفلح الكافرون. And had not Allah been gracious to us, he might have made the earth swallow us too. Oh, that the unbelievers do not prosper. So, Islam does not oppose wealth totally, but this kind of wealth, which is gathered in one place and is not being given to the needy ones, this is totally opposed by Islam. And Islam admires a wealth in which this meaning is seen, this meaning of khayr is seen. Because in the Holy Quran it is said, "And so not forget your portion in this world." So we can say, as our final stance, that Islam seeks for a wealth which is not the cause of mischief on the earth, forgetting the human values, being involved in the race of amassing wealth and multiplication of properties and children. Islam does not draw man toward this kind of amassing wealth. This kind of wealth, which is actually rendering self-admiration and humiliating others, this is opposed by Islam. And even this kind of wealth that we saw, even was used opposing the divine prophets, as we saw in our stories mentioned regarding these last two verses. Let's have a break and we'll be back. So, brothers and sisters, as we saw and understood from the story of Qarun, wealth must be a means for the benefits of others, for filling the present economic gaps, for using as a remedy upon the worrying wounds of the deprived, upon being applied for removing the needs, removing the difficulties of the oppressed. This is how Islam suggests that wealth must be used. And being interested in such a wealth with such aims is not an attachment to the world, because it is an attachment to hereafter. The one who is having and using this kind of wealth is using it for the abode of hereafter. And it is said in the tradition that one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam came to him and said as a grievance that they were after the world and they were interested in it. And they were afraid of becoming mammonist. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam know the purity and virtue of that man. He knew it in the first place. He said, "What do you want to do with this wealth of the world?" And that man answered, "I want to supply the expenditure for myself, for my household, help my relatives, spend in the way of Allah, perform pilgrimage and lesser pilgrimage." And Imam Sadiq said, it is not to seek the world. This is to seek the hereafter. So here, the corruption of the belief of two groups is made manifest. A group of people who are apparently Muslims, but they are unaware of the teachings of Islam. And they introduce Islam as the supporter of the tyrant oppressors. And a group of self-interested enemies who want to show the feature of Islam wrongly and try to introduce it as a religion opposing wealth, an adherent of poverty. A tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam makes it clear. The needlessness that hinders you from injustice and violating others' right is better than the poverty that makes you commit sin. And the Islamic communities must try and do their best to become rich, to become needless from others, from non-Islamic nations specifically, and they must not devote their modesty, honor, and independence for depending on others. And they must know this, that they must be independent. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
People that wanted to visit the city of Shiraz would go through the Quran gate. But nowadays, with the volume of cars, only people pass. Join me as I visit the city of Shiraz.
The Quran gate is the first thing you'll notice as you enter the city from the north, as two old copies of Islam's holy book was kept here in the past. Just at the entrance of the city also lies the statue of Haju Kermani, a poet and mystic from the 14th century. His poems are mostly about spirituality. His works are believed to have influenced another Iranian poet called Hafiz, which we'll get to later in this program. Haju Kermani traveled to many lands during his time, but that stopped when he came to Shiraz.
The city of Shiraz is known for its poets and poetry. Many renowned Iranian poets lived here. Haju Kermani, when he visited the city of Shiraz, he never left.
This is likely because the rulers of this land valued arts.
The Arg of Karim Khan is a citadel built during the 18th century as the living headquarters of Karim Khanazam himself. Later it was a prison, and now it's a museum, which we can enter.
Karim Khanazam founded the Zand dynasty and declared Shiraz his capital, and thus many buildings were erected in this city during his rule.
The architecture of the citadel combines military and residential architecture, as it was the home of Karim Khanazam and also the head of his military headquarters.
But Karim Khan was different from other rulers of the time. When he came to power, he refused to be called king. He accepted the title, the Advocate of the People, that is Vakil in Persian. Many structures built during his time carry Vakil in their name. Stained glass goes hand in hand with Iranian architecture. From homes to palaces, most windows were decorated this way. But it wasn't just for beauty.
The interesting thing about tinted glass is it's first soothing for the environment and for the eyes, and also it keeps the insects away, they say. I don't see any insects here, do you?
Next stop is the Vakil bathhouse. A place where people from all walks of life would chit-chat and also bathe. At the entry, every part of the society had their own section, and many of the people's problems were resolved just here. It was like the city's or the town's informal council. And about the building itself,
and even in this building, which is a bathhouse, there's lots of detail put in the architecture. So this shows you how much Iranians valued every single building, even a bathhouse. Let's go and check out the rest.
Walking through this bath, I saw wall after wall of detail put in the making. And it's quite big for a place to bathe. But this also shows this place was more like a hangout or a place they would spend hours in. Not just a quick shower like we do today. And may I remind you, They didn't shower every day in the old days.
This place was way more than a bathhouse. Like, for example, one person's having a scrub, the other's having a massage, and of course, one of them is bathing. And on the other side, there's one person getting a haircut, a shave, and that guy there got his tooth pulled out.
The Vakil Mosque is another landmark of Shiraz. The 48 columns in its prayer hall, carved in spirals, are one of its outstanding features. Next is Bazar Vakil, a big market still in use today to find everything from Shiraz and beyond. From spices and herbs to sweets and confectionery, and many, many more, this is the place to visit. You can find every kind of souvenir here, many cool things you can buy, and every quarter has its own goods. One unique part in this bazaar is where several hallways meet.
Okay, many of Iran's bazaars are similar in shape. But the difference for the bazaar in Shiraz is this little part here is called the Saraye Murshid, where you can get your hands on many little things, like little antiques, little jewelry, or little souvenirs where you can take home.
Talking about cool things, there was also an antique shop that topped my list. The Vakil Bazaar is one of the longest stretching and most famous bazaars in Iran. It is located in the center of Shiraz and is amongst Iran's national heritage sites. Saadi, another one of the renowned poets of this land. He was born in Shiraz. He spent more than 2 decades traveling outside of Persia following the Mongol invasion. His works reflect upon the lives of ordinary people suffering displacement, agony, and conflict. His best-known works, Bustan, meaning the orchard, and Golestan, the rose garden, consist of stories illustrating the standard virtues recommended to Muslims, being justice, kindness, modesty, and gratification.
Saadi is one of the most famous Iranian poets of all time. His poetry is seen all over the world, not just in Iran. One of the verses that is seen in the UN building in New York is, "All men and women are to each other the limbs of a single body, each of us drawn from life's shimmering essence, God's perfect pearl. And when this life we share wounds one of us, all share the hurt as if it were our own. You who will not feel another's pain, you forfeit the right to be called human." This was just one.
And talking about flowers and gardens, the city of Shiraz is also famous for its Persian gardens. And in spring, the scent of flowers fills the sky in this city. The whole city is like a big flower shop. And last but not least is Persian poet Hafez. He was a spiritual poet and mystic known by his pen name Hafez. It means a person that knows the Quran by heart. It is believed that he also knew the works of Saadi, Rumi, and several other poets by heart too. His mausoleum located in a garden is where people gather to recite his poems, relax, and enjoy the environment. It's a popular hangout for artists in Shiraz.
Hafez, one of the most prominent Iranian poets of all time. While he passed away several centuries ago, still you can find his poems in the homes of Iranians today. So this shows you how important he was in Persian literature. Some regard him as the pinnacle of Persian literature.
And a goodbye from Shiraz. I'm Pedram Khaledadi for the Iran program.
too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper-thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the hall of shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. But thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too
good day to all of our listeners from all around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. If you're eager to know more about what's going on around the world, then this is for you. Round the World with Reporters. It's filled up with fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. That will be followed by Minbar. The program covers speeches on various subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and narrators. Then it is time for Varied Radio Productions feature. And our final program this hour is Quran Quest. If you want to know more about the Holy Quran, then this program is definitely for you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Almost 58,000 people have been killed by the Israeli regime in Gaza since the start of the genocide. Now, 187 civil society organizations and trade unions from across Europe have published a joint letter demanding that the EU suspends all official ties with Tel Aviv, a position backed by many EU legislators.
Iran replied to an Israeli illegal attack by bombing Israel. Okay, it's easy to condemn Iran, as you have done time and time again. But over the last years, Israel has bombed, what is it, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Sudan, Yemen. Of course, Palestine is illegally occupying Palestine, parts of Syria, illegally occupying parts of Lebanon. Are you able to condemn this?
Islamic Republic of Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency is being accused of acting as a tool of the US and Israel in an effort to discredit Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. Simultaneously, many EU lawmakers say the West is complicit in Israel's campaign to starve Palestinians. People on the streets of Brussels seem to agree.
A lot of people are dying, a lot of kids. It's not a good situation.
I think the Israelis are scum of the earth.
It's a tragic crisis, no matter how you look at it or how you describe it.
I hope one day it will be better for them.
It's suggested that EU political leaders are enabling Israeli aggression because they fear upsetting the United States.
In fact, instead of holding Israel to account, President von der Leyen has Netanyahu, a war criminal, on speed dial, and she's actively encouraging to carry out illegal strikes on Iran.
Fresh calls have been made in the European Parliament for EU countries to close their airspace to Benjamin Netanyahu and enforce the arrest warrant issued against him by the International Criminal Court. Critics argue that the EU's credibility is in tatters due to its glaringly inconsistent foreign policy, imposing 18 rounds of tough sanctions against Russia, yet failing to take any meaningful action against the Israeli regime, despite an ever-growing catalogue of atrocities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A potential diplomatic thaw may be on the horizon between Iran and the United States. This, according to Iran's top foreign policy think tank, the Institute for Political and International Studies, IPIS. Experts examined the high stakes and uncertainties of renewed Iran-U.S. diplomacy.
There are many ambiguities, but also there are many things that, you know, we can talk about, including Iran's consistent policy of trying to keep peace. We are an anchor of stability in this region. We are a civilization. We have been here for millennia.
Participants reiterated that Iran remains committed to diplomacy, but trust has eroded.
As you saw, they were attacking all our nuclear sites, which were under IAEA constant monitoring and under the safeguard, which is the grave violation of international law. We tried also to be very measured and proportionate in our response to this aggression. Our act of defense was under Article 51 of UN Charter, but at the same time very much strategically calculated to avoid the spread of this war to the Persian Gulf and to our region.
The events also shed light on the recent geopolitical miscalculations by Israel and the United States and their failure to achieve their strategic goals.
Iran is still trying to be measured and also trying to be very calculated. But God forbidden, if the day come and they pose any existential threat, as they sometimes you are hearing from the other side of the Atlantic, then Iran will be a different Iran. What Iran did by showing the capacity and capability of targeting, even by informing them that we are going to attack different sites, and we did it. It was a manifestation of the will and the capacity of Tehran, and this very strong message that enough is enough. Our region is very much exhausted and tired of these violations and war, and we hope that the others have got this message clearly.
According to the speakers, Iran's measured military response has shifted the narrative, forcing a reassessment in Washington. As this webinar underscores, Iran's resilience stands firm. While Israeli and U.S. objectives remain unmet, it is Tehran now that is charting its own path forward and changing the narrative. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
For
for the first time since launching its military operation in Jenin camp in late January, Israel has allowed 25 Palestinian women to briefly return to the camp. The entry was granted in coordination with the Palestinian liaison. However, three of the women were still denied access despite prior approval.
A soldier stopped us from going in, even though we had coordination. I only wanted to enter the camp, see its streets, its alleys, and my home. I wasn't going in to collect belongings. It's been 6 months since we were displaced. We haven't seen our homes. We used to stand on the edge of the mountain just to catch a glimpse. They forced us out, and we were left with nothing.
Among those who was allowed to enter the camp was Sahar Abu Zaini, who was displaced several times since 2020.
We have lived through many rounds of displacement, but this one is the most painful, both in terms of the days we are enduring and the number of martyrs and the wounded. Also, we carry the weight of what's happening in Gaza, which surpasses even our own suffering. We ask God for strength and compensation for the pain we face.
This isn't just about demolishing buildings. The Israeli regime is trying to reshape life in the camp entirely. The demolished houses represent entire lives and memories that the regime has erased.
The situation in the camp isn't like it used to be at all. All the houses are damaged, destroyed, and affected. My feeling is a mix of joy and sadness. I saw my house for the first time in 6 months. It was heavy when I returned to my house and saw it, even though it was badly affected, but we hope to return to the camp and rebuild it again.
Across the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinians continue to face forced displacement and the destruction of their homes. But despite all that, they remain determined to stay on their land.
The occupying Israeli regime is changing the entire life structure of the residents of the Jenin camp by altering not only the physical space, but leaving the inhabitants, who are deeply attached to the camp, with no alternative options to make their lives sustainable. Tibasi, occupied Jenin.
Detonating cords, ammonium nitrate, tritium are among the materials Italy's far-right government has been illegally supplying to the Israeli regime since the start of the Gaza war in early October 2023. This is the outcome of an investigative report by the Altra Economia magazine. The report was presented on Tuesday during a public conference held at a branch premise of the Italian Senate in Rome. Despite the Italian government's denials, the magazine has exposed how the executive led by Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has been increasingly providing Tel Aviv with dual-use materials that can be easily used to build explosive or even develop thermonuclear bombs.
Italy never ever exported detonating cords nor ammonium nitrate to Israel before 2023. One could say these materials are intended for civilian purposes. However, the high quantities of exported ammonium nitrate leads us to think that it is destined for military use. As for tritium, Italy does not even produce it. Rome buys it from Germany. Rome's sale of tritium to Israel has guaranteed revenues from just a few thousand euros in October 2023 to 1.5 million euros in 2024.
During the conference, it was pointed out that these dual-use materials have been shipped to Israel through Italian companies not authorized to trade weapons. Italian magistrates have opened an investigation into a shipment of more than 13 tons of metal components destined for Israel and held at the port of Ravenna on the Adriatic coast. Since the start of the Gaza war, Italian firms have also been selling Israel light weapons, ammunition, and spare parts for M-346 trainer aircraft, acting in violation of Italy's constitution and laws.
The outcome of the magazine's report is extremely grave. Magistrates must investigate these circumstances. If our government is violating Italian norms and arms smuggling, Italy would be an accomplice in Israel's Gaza genocide.
By supporting Israel, Italy has chosen to be on the wrong side of history. Rome is completely subjugated. Disregarding international norms will lead the world to a future of wars and insecurity.
Italy is the third largest seller of arms to Israel after the United States and Germany. Over the past months, mass pro-Palestine marches have been held in Rome to denounce what the protesters see as the Italian complicity with the Israeli regime in the Gaza genocide. More and more Italians have finally realized the nefarious role played by Israel and the United States in West Asia. Max Civili, Rome.
A chilling new trend is emerging in the Israeli military's genocidal campaign in Gaza. The systematic targeting of civilian cafes, lounges, and local gathering spots. Over the past few weeks, airstrikes have increasingly hit these densely populated civilian areas during peak hours, with cafes and social hubs becoming a recurring target. The Gaza Ministry of Health confirmed that dozens have been killed in at least six separate attacks on cafes and social venues in the past 10 days alone. The most prominent was when the Israeli warplanes dropped a powerful 5-ton MK-82 bomb on the Al-Baqa cafe, teeming with families, students, journalists and artists, which resulted in at least 30 fatalities.
It was a war crime. This place was full of people fleeing the scorching heat of the tent and the lack of electricity, and came to do their work, to study and to connect with their friends. The surrounding was also full of displaced families and tents. This was a war crime that can never be justified.
This pattern of attacks appears to be a deliberate tactic to maximize civilian casualties and the psychological devastation among the people who cling to any thread of a normal life.
Beyond the physical destruction, the deliberate targeting of cafes and lounges strikes at the heart of Gaza's social and cultural life. In a region where power outages, displacement, and trauma are the realities of every day, at Ibrahim Gaza City.
As the U.S.-Israeli attempted genocide in Gaza reaches 21 months, Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Washington amid a major protest against his arrival at the White House. It was widely reported that a ceasefire was going to be announced.
This is such a crime on such magnitude that we'll be talking for generations about this starvation and shooting. It's hard to comprehend, to be honest. It's like a nightmare that never ends. So this is the opportunity, Mr. Trump. This is your chance. Make the difference.
In what many called a twisted contradiction, no ceasefire was announced, but Netanyahu did say he had formally nominated Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. The continued refusal of a ceasefire left many saying that Tel Aviv seeks nothing less than the complete eradication of Gaza and its people, and that only Washington could turn off the war machine.
I would like to see the U.S. first and foremost stop all arms to Israel, and they need to flood Gaza with aid. People are starving to death. People have no water. Babies have no formula. It's absolutely immoral and disgusting, and we need to get them aid as soon as possible. And it's completely possible. It's all in the hands of President Trump.
Poll after poll continues to show that support for Israel has plunged to once unthinkable levels, especially among Democrats and Americans under 50 years old.
I don't think so. Changed enough, so I don't understand how we could be still supporting Israel. Last week we sent them a little over $500 million for new weapons. I don't understand how we could be supporting Israel at all. So I wouldn't consider whatever amount of change has been to be enough. So it doesn't impress me.
As a result of their disastrous 12-day war on Iran, the two leaders are now forced to pivot from promises of regional domination and Iranian collapse to some sort of a new strategy. What appears certain to many are their likely goals: continued U.S. imperialism, an end to organized opposition toward Zionism, thwarting the democratic self-determination of the average Arab, and all at whatever the cost to Palestinian, Arab, and Iranian lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Daily Twitter and first displacement. This is the reality for Palestinians in the northern Jordan Valley.